Iambic Audio presents Fight for Your Long Day by Alex Kudera. Read by Mark F. Smith. Man was born free, and he is everywhere in chains. One man thinks himself the master of others, but remains more of a slave than they. From Jean-Jacques Rousseau, The Social Contract, 1762. Chapter 1. Safely Ensconced on the Home Front. Even on his long day, Cyrus Duffelman enjoys the fact that he can sip strong coffee and watch TV news before leaving his apartment 5 minutes past the opening bell of the New York Stock Exchange. The conga drummers living above his tiny studio own a satellite dish, so this is his free cable and time of the day. As he owns the most meager of holdings and no retirement plan, the green and red arrows of the futures markets are only a peripheral concern. What seems more of interest, and even shamefully soothing in its routine, are the news crawler updates on soldiers, civilians, and enemy combatants who are maimed, killed, or otherwise blown apart in battle, while shopping, or by suicide bomb. The dry plains of this Middle Eastern desert lie far, far away, but indisputably dominate Duffelman's era and psyche. Over there, the bad news is always happening the night after or the previous day. The time zone's never part of Cyrus's expertise. Although he knows such analogies could be unpatriotic, tasteless, or even criminal, he sees himself as a foot soldier on the front lines of America's knowledge-based economy. The degree-granting, price-gouging, 4-year university. His war is not so much on terror, and only occasionally and tangentially on drugs. Rather, the battleground lies in the classroom where the strong survive to reap their reward in the form of middle and upper-class lives and lifestyles, while the weak perish into the poverty of high school diplomacy. For the cannon-fodder majority, the inability to pay educational loans is the only lasting sign of ever having attended college in the first place. Each week, Duffy, mostly but upon occasion a potent Duff or unpredictable Duffler, guards the gate at 4 institutions, and on his long day, Thursday, he teaches or tutors at all of them. Backed only by commercial catastrophic health coverage, he stands alert to all kinds of student complaints, parried blows, fits and elbows, verbal shots fired from the back rows, the baseball-capped white boy section, where blank, inscrutable faces stare back at his writing classes. Whether or not it is truly the age of information, or in fact the age of terror, as his televised leaders claim, he is certainly a guardsman of the noble, hegemonic power of the time, a sentry at the door of the baccalaureate degree. His would-be warning to all who dare pass. Read and write until you have piercing headaches and weighty paper or plastic bags under the eyes, a fat lump of gut precisely antithetical to the torsos of ancient Greece or Rome, and an education just slightly obsolete in this age of technologically enhanced cleavage and visual display. But succumbing to the virtual moment, that wide world of in-text solicitation and file-attached aggression, websites informing of and advocating for all manner of breasts and bombs, he assigns no more than 20 pages per class. Duffy accepts his adjunct status and pay, choosing to ignore the fact that most college instructors earn less than sanitation engineers and public bus drivers, and significantly less than sales professionals and accountants, never mind the management types in pornography and terrorism. This information is easily accessed by his site-surfing students, and so, to the Googling masses, he is the messenger worth ignoring, dismissing, blankly smiling at, flirting with, or worse if it would help the grade, and in his most paranoid vision, shooting. But by most legal interpretations, concealing weapons on campus remains beyond the pale, so he never wears his bulletproof vest to the classroom, the souvenir his sister's husband purchased for him the holiday season following the Twin Tower attacks. After all, some students are paid for by parents, grandparents, merit and need-based grants, and even for the majority, the huge loans loom so far in the distance that apathy, as much as antagonism, is the undergrad's response to his lectures and tedious essay assignments. At times, the absurd sums noted on each semester's billing statement lead students to believe their teacher must be one of the wealthy reapers of financial rewards. After all, he is the professor, that middle-aged pale mass at the front of the room, even occasionally dressed entirely in corduroy. In the conservative family scenario, he is seen as the exact same rich, liberal professor up at that state school the old man has imagined, growled about, and warned his kid against. Just smile at all that bullshit. Act like you agree, grab your B, and fuck him in the ballot box, 'cause he and his tenured buddies don't know jack shit about the real world. But Duffy has pride, and so he rarely, if ever, discloses to a class of 19-year-old debtors his actual wages, a meager pittance that would make the overly loaned feel even worse. Instead, during his daily tour of duty, he ignores his personal squalor and his aching discs and arches, the remedying physical therapy several thousands out of reach. Now, at 9:28 a.m., Duffy succumbs to his couch, clean-shaven and a moment removed from his second toilet sitting, one less than his morning norm. He never dresses until the very last moment of morning calm, but stays in worn gray boxer briefs and a white undershirt, his back sunk deep into the middle of the couch, which is already malformed from this daily habit. With his calves propped up and resting flat atop a short breakfast bar stool used alternately for food and his feet, he stares at the 20-inch television screen. Today, the tube projects an image of a slow-paced speaker, a man of short words and long pauses. "I'd like to introduce you to a man." Pause. "He was an able man." Pause. Pause. "He is a solid man." Pause. "He is a man who helped lead the war on terror." Has Duffy mistakenly changed the channel to a children's educational show? Is an adult reading to small children with some other matter on his mind? Back to televised reality, he hears, "And I will miss him." Alert again, and out of his early morning, absent-minded reverie, he recognizes that indeed he is breaking fast with the President of the United States of America, his articulations living proof that all of his messages to students about proficiency and expertise in reading and writing and speaking as the best path to the lofty perches in our sacred land are, well, perhaps just a bunch of bunk. The national news types bid all a fond farewell, the image of the president disappears, and commercials follow. Sincere actors and toll-free numbers attack and molest him. Duffy has no truck with incontinence pads or toilet bowl cleaner, but at this time of the day wishes their advocates would let him be. After the raised volume and carefree jingle of a supersized McBreakfast, the local news blasts its energizing beat. The reports on gun crimes and fires fought can flood his brain with adrenaline and nostalgia, and these two natural highs are usually enough to get him off the couch and out of the apartment. "Good morning, Philadelphia. In the news at 9:30 a.m., graft at City Hall, dead deer in Fairmount Park, murder in North Philadelphia, a fire in Logan. But now for our top story. The Undersecretary of Homeland Defense is in town today to dedicate Liberty Tech's Institute for Homeland Security, the first structure built for their multi-billion dollar graduate school of defense technology. Live at Liberty Tech, here's our very own Brenda Glantz. Brenda?" Duffy stares at the black steel and glass structure, surrounded by a concrete and cement campus, that is his second school of the day.
"Good morning, Don.
Here we are in front of the new Institute for Homeland Security, part of the new William Winsome School of Defense Technology, and I'm joined now by one of the benefactors who made this graduate program possible. Let me introduce Lawrence Neil O'Connor. Mr. O'Connor, many benefactors on college campuses name buildings after themselves. What made you decide to honor the 40th President of the United States of America?
William Winsome was a great man. He ended the Cold War and brought peace and prosperity to the American people. He's a dying breed. We wanted to honor the man.
The announcer pauses, as if stunned by the direct praise of the dying breed, the dead president. Then, after a moment, Brenda Glantz turns to the camera, smiles, and says, "Don, back to you." The benefactor, his news lady, and the black glass and steel architecture disappear from view, replaced by Ernest Don, whose smile has turned to a slight but solemn frown.
In other news, overnight, the animal killer of Fairmount Park has struck again. We go live to the scene of this latest gruesome tragedy. Earl?
A green woodsy area overwhelms the screen, and Duffy feels relieved that his cement future has for the moment disappeared. Replacing anchor Don is reporter Earl Watkins in a yellow rain poncho, with a background of animal rights protesters shouting,
"Hell no, we won't go!"
There has been another gruesome discovery in the Fairmount Park section of Philadelphia. Two joggers, running together to protect themselves against the Fairmount Park serial rapist, came upon three dead deer lined up together in the middle of the jogging path. Each deer had been shot in the side by what looks to be the kind of arrow shot from a bow. Two were found dead, and the third one, tragically, died as veterinarians from the Park Outreach Program were arranging transportation out of the park to the Collegetown Animal Hospital. Now police are cordoning off the scene with yellow crime tape. The camera pans away from Earl to a few cops in the background, who appear to be taping trees in slow motion, either milking the overtime pay or instructed to wait for the job to be caught on film. Then, back to Earl.
As you can see behind me, this latest killing has brought people out to Fairmount Park today. Animal rights activists are protesting what they feel is the police's failure to protect the wildlife of Fairmount Park. I have here with me now Julian Dore, leader of a group called the People's Revolutionary Animal Protection Party. Julian, what does your group think about these horrible crimes?
Horrible crimes is right, sir. These are crimes against humanity here, sir. We demand immediate increases in police protection for our animal brethren making their home in Fairmount Park. The squirrels, the deer, the occasional possum and raccoon all deserve our protection. We wouldn't be here healthy today were it not for the ecosystem, and it is up to all of us to work together to ensure the survival of all species. Man can cause extinction, but man can also make the difference. We are planning a march on City Hall later today, 3 p.m., to let the mayor know we will not tolerate this kind of animal abuse in our city. We demand justice. We demand animal rights.
The crowd in the background shouts and screams, following their leader.
We demand justice. We demand animal rights.
They wave their signs and hop up and down, dreadlocks aflame, making their point known. Duffelman, suffering from low caffeine levels and 10 years of adjunct drudgery, is shocked to see people so full of energy so early in the morning. Dore. Julian Dore? The name lingers in his conscious state. It means something to him, but he can't place it this early in the morning. Perhaps this boy Julian was one of his former students? There was always a few of the protest ilk, particularly at Urban State, where, he notes, he is due to teach in 30 minutes.
Oh, shit! 9:40, and now 9:41 a.m., according to the time and temperature on the blue background just above the stock quote corner of the screen.
To meet his Tuesday-Thursday schedule, he needs to be out the door at 9:35 sharp to arrive at his first class in a timely fashion. Now he is 6 minutes late. Channel changer in hand, Duffy shoots dead his screen, springs from the couch, shotguns his tall glass of tap water, and swallows the last half cup of lukewarm coffee, praying he receives not the shits while sampling public transportation. After throwing on a gray and worn thin wool sweater and stepping into functional beige khakis, finally socks, shoes, and deodorant in case he forgot, he darts around his tiny two-room studio, searching for his umbrella, which he remembers he has been unable to find since the start of April. But he sees from his window that it's only drizzling, and he lowers each window to 2 inches so as to let in air but keep out any watery gusts during the day. He turns off the coffee pot and checks to make sure the toaster oven is switched off. Then he glances down at the oven knobs as he presses firmly against the refrigerator door to test its airtight seal, steps back to the bathroom to make sure the toilet water isn't running, but as he does so, in double-checking the coffee pot, he sees the milk is still out on the counter, and so he returns it to the refrigerator, rechecks the oven knobs with his left hand as he firmly presses the fridge again with his right, and then double-checks the radio despite its silence as he returns to the bathroom and finds all fixtures secure, and not a droplet of sound. He opens the tiny bathroom window as wide as it will go, admires the branch that has been growing off the plastic windowsill, a tree seed and soil apparently found its way to the perfect humidity of a window by the shower, and then moves back to the bedroom to double-check the computer switch and the back window, where the terrorist or burglar would likely sneak in, and finally grabs his jacket and book bag, walks out of his apartment door, and locks it behind him. As he takes 2 steps down the stairs, he realizes he has forgotten his granola breakfast bar and peanut butter and cheese cracker snack, the 2 items he needs to save $3 on snacks from the food carts around campus. So he fusses with his key, re-enters the apartment, grabs the snacks, eyes the coffee pot one last time, lowers his hulking bag to the floor as he tosses on his jacket, lifts the bag, and then locks the door, hurrying down the steps before he can remember to check anything else. Outside, where the drizzle has picked up to a steady light rain, he gets wet and checks his watch, 9:44 a.m. Duffy has no time for the calm ride of the slightly out-of-the-way suburban trains, so he rushes for the subway, pacing as briskly as possible without falling on his ass. His shoes are an investment. They are made of a synthetic material used for walker models, with good traction and better arch support. He fondly recalls paying $12 extra to buy the pair with waterproofing. As he marches forward, head tilted down enough to avoid puddles but still see approaching pedestrians, his glasses catch the water. A constant drip from the upper rim of the frame plops down just below each eye. At 9:45, not many are out walking, not in this rain, most having already made it to work, and not yet prepared to venture outside for their morning smoke. In the underpass below the trains, Duffy indulges in 30 yards of dry. As he returns to getting wet, to his left he passes the Drew Building, where they award generous stipends for fiction, poetry, and plays. His terminal degree states that he has a master's in the so-called fine art of creative writing, and he applied years ago, long before the 7 deadly sins of literary blockage, daily drudgery, anxiety, low self-esteem, depression, lack of talent and ambition, and above all, laziness, stole away any chance he had of concentrating for long enough to produce anything even loosely resembling a work of art, or tight and tidy enough to be considered that marketable commodity, the contemporary novel. Even in his overworked state, he still remembers to brood and mutter bitterly each time photos of smiling prize winners are published. From Duffy's perspective, there seems to be something politically correct, connected, or insubstantial about every finalist. Who has ever heard of writers smiling so widely? These winners could not be writers worth reading.
Awash in envy, he sees it all as one steamy lump, a movement of the ordinary, produced by the educated but scared.
The winner's writing takes less risk than a political front-runner in a national election.
He could admit that it shows far superior craftsmanship than his endless comments on student essays,
all he could claim as his own oeuvre. Such self-crunching honesty doesn't make him feel any better. And so, with no time to stare at the imposing gray marble, Duffy trudges on. Just as he briskly approaches and then dexterously stops at the red light at the corner of 21st and Market, a huge SEPTA bus headed west on Market plows past, drenching him from his knees to his shoulders with a shockwave of rainwater. Gathering his wits, he feels grateful this bonus soaking doesn't come with muddy sprinkles on top. When he crosses, looking both ways, Duffy bravely fingers the bus already a block away. Past the firehouse and the adult book center and peep shows, whose bright red neon distracts him for only the briefest of seconds, he begins the steep descent to the 22nd and Market eastbound subway surface platform, hoping, as he does so, that he encounters only sane people below. Although the new gourmet market has brought the middle class, yuppies, buppies, two-earner families, and trust fund slackers, back to the station, particularly after work, Duffy remains cautious. Interaction with the half-clad, salivating, mentally ill, or emotionally disturbed is more than he can handle, particularly at such an early hour. That each day includes an inordinate amount of interaction with himself makes life troubling enough. After a slow, careful, one-step-at-a-time descent of the deep cement stairwell, his glasses fog up entirely with the temperature change. A trolley's distant squeal transforms to a roar and culminates in a screeching halt. In his haste to progress, he at first shoves and nearly pushes down an elderly woman he cannot see, but then holds her up until he can steady them both. A moment for a deep breath, and then he makes sure that she boards safely ahead of his oafishness, all the while apologizing profusely, and at last stepping up and into the crowded car. With a tissue from his jacket, he clears his glasses to see the huge driver staring at him menacingly because he witnessed the entire episode. He absorbs the driver's glare as acknowledgment that he is the worst kind of middle-aged white man in control of the universe, the kind who would run down an old lady in pursuit of daily bread, and no doubt take more than his share. So Duffy returns the look with sad eyes expressing the guilt of millions, perhaps his paternal grandfather's buried bones in the mix. At most 37.5% Jewish, and rarely feeling like much more of a man than that, nevertheless, culpability for this crime against humanity, this near-toppling of a senior citizen, washes across his brow. For a moment, he imagines he knows what it is like to be black, or even poor. He then recalls that by data gleaned from several surveys, he tilts toward poverty, or at least a lower quintile, so he shakes his head vigorously, as if such brisk exertion could shake out such race or class-based understanding of the world. He then slides his monthly pass through the slot and turns to meet his fellow passengers. Posture poor and folded into most of their seats, overweight brown and black Philadelphians abound, the drab colors of rain jackets and sad or expressionless eyes presciently complimenting the rainy day. But there are also careerist, high thread count African Americans and others standing near the front, most of them appearing more erect and fit than the slouching writing instructor. He pushes past a few thin Asian girls he often sees in Center City, of varying economic classes and regions of origin, South or East or Southeastern, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, or Asia, most fully hyphenated, and a few of ambiguous first language or visa status, but all in tight blue jeans or professional attire. As a people, they appear to have lives and diets. They do not cluster together, and so an attitude of individualism appears alive underneath their name brands. He pauses to marvel at these tender morsels of accessible flesh, packaged tightly in designer wrap, and for a moment feels privileged to bear witness to the freedom of the West. But to Duffy, alas, such fruit is forbidden, and with his throat dry and stomach rumbling, he damns himself thrice over, first for seeing so much ethnic difference, second for being such a filthy old man, and third for daring to desire the prohibited in a way that could get him tortured or maimed by radical fundamentalists. He squeezes through the packed-in passengers to find himself wedged between an enormous black woman and a middle-aged hippie. The latter is ostensibly a white male without a harem or wife or clutter of exes, the poorer kind, perhaps laid off, disabled, idled, or otherwise ignored on the employment rolls. Duffy senses that he sees one not unlike himself. Despite this shared life experience, when his nose gets stuck in the hippie's long locks, he feels disgusted and angry. He can smell the pungency of unwashed dreads. Days, months, even a decade would be possible, and overpowered by this evil wafting, he can barely appreciate or even feel the shock of terror over the arousal he feels from the huge woman's bosom thrust forward and flopping down into the small of his back. Forced to stare downward, Duffy cannot ignore the bald fact that the hippie rides without shoes, sandals, or any other footwear to protect his tan and yellowish heels and toes from the God knows what of public transportation. At 19th Street, a few depart, or pop out as the doors open, and Duffy feels himself rearranged like one of the candies in a gumball machine. He winds up briefly on a tight-jeaned lap, Vietnamese or perhaps Laotian, who with long nails pinches his neck, the sharp pain succeeding in driving him off and vertical again, this time his face 6 inches from the hippie's beard. In the beard he sees every manner of refuse from the ages, the red of tomato sauce stains, a fleck of silver, protest posters from decades ago, all in thick-knitted tufts of light brown and gray. When he moves his eyes up and away, the hippie smiles directly at him. Is it a knowing look? Congenial? Conspiratorial? Lewd? Duffy isn't sure, but doesn't have time to find out, as the trolley lurches to a halt at 15th Street. He is among the last to pile out, just behind a purple dreadlocked crusty punk whose perfect cleavage under army camouflage reads, "College is a scar," until the last half-letter renders visible the fact it was a scam all along. Into the dirty, dark, cavernous central pulse of public transport, he is but another cow in the common herd. Nevertheless, as an individual, he is cautious and nimble in foot placement, seeking to avoid water puddles and the multitudes of gum droppings both fresh and aged. Good soldier and obedient commuter, he follows the others up the filthy, blackened cement steps and around the bend, 2 90-degree rights, toward the Orange Line, the north-south Broad Street line. As he descends onto the Market Street elevated line's underground center city platform, he sees a huge pinkish-pale cop holding the leash of a seated German shepherd. The dog has soft, innocent eyes, antithetical to his master's reputation as a mean-spirited boy in blue. They are there to protect America from violence, both imported and domestic, but no Americans stand anywhere close to their defenders. As he walks past the dog and cop, Duffy glances at the various commuters, striking their poses at 10 in the morning. One is seated with a cup of coffee. Another stands peering at a folded newspaper. A pitch-black obese man in a brown cloth kanga hat stares back, reminding him it's safer to stare at the ground. No one likes being stared at, particularly not in the subway, particularly not by a sad, sallow stranger. Eyes to the ground and plodding forward, Duffy is nagged by a severe urge to pee. To fight the bladder that be, he picks up his pace. He is, after all, on the verge of arriving more than the permissible 5 minutes late, and marches on. The corridor narrows everyone to single file, commuters trudging one behind the other, weary, sluggish soldiers who cannot keep the beat. Pungent smells of stale coffee, perspiration, cheap perfume, and old urine compete for notice in the corridor. And then worse, ominous scents hit him, like the shit is about to go down, so strong in his nostrils that Duffy's ecstasy knows no bounds when the corridor widens once more, and an almost jovial newspaper hawker shouts out, "Deer lynched in the park! American troops dead again! Read all about it! 2 papers for $1! Somehow, the Philadelphia newspaper salesmen have been selling 2 papers to the same customer. For $1, you could get 2 copies of the Daily News at a savings of 20 cents total, an Inquirer and a Daily News at a savings of 10 cents total, or 2 Inquirers at no savings at all. Although he has read that math is an obsolete language, public school children headed calculators instead of Cuisenaire rods, and that the Daily News is said to be written on the 3rd grade level, and the inky only the 5th, he has trouble fathoming who would be buying into such a scam. In the age of the Internet, who would be reading both newspapers, or requiring a copy of the exact same thing? Nonetheless, as he passes the vendor, a lady says, "Two Daily News, sir," and he sees her handing the man a crumpled bill. Duffy weaves around another beefy cop, this one sans Shepherd and more menacing to account for this lack, and turns down a narrow flight of stairs with unwashed white tiles for walls, revealing a permanent rainbow of underground grime. Graffiti gets professionally washed away, but some dirt and water stains last forever. On the subway platform, he passes a blank-faced wall of black teenagers, none of whom look old enough to be out of school at this hour. Maybe in another time, another community, a caring adult would talk to the boys, find out if they're late or lost, warn them against truancy, and perhaps even offer them cab fare, a SEPTA token, assistance in getting to school or calling a parent. But these days, today, the student could have a temper or carry a knife or gun, or even an acutely contagious STD, according to televised news. So we leave such inquiry to the cops, who are presently occupied striking their own pose in the war on terror. He paces past and finds a small gap on a metal bench between 2 students with eyes stuck in their books. In the mornings, these studious ones cramming in the subway give Duffy a bit of hope for the future. Sometimes he sees one with a novel, deeply engrossed in its contents, possibly even unassigned reading for pleasure. Now, on the cramped bench, he is forced to look straight ahead, in this case at a large yellow sign depicting people in jeans and sneakers with cardboard boxes shoved over their heads. "Labels are for packages," the large lettering reads. Duffy, so fagged, doesn't get it. His early morning hunger pangs for something easier to understand. He glances left to see supersized ads for bright red burgers and fries, and then right, yet more ads for treating anxiety and depression. "If you or anyone you know is suffering..." Then the roar approaches, the train doors open, the masses depart, and those like Duffy, headed to North Philadelphia, surge into each car and fill up the seats. Through the opposite window, he sees the yellow sign's smaller print, "Embrace Difference! Embrace America!" He looks around desperately for dissimilar citizenry whom he could hug or even offer the seat he is about to sit in. He aims for non-white, but is willing to settle for female, older, younger, or overtly happy. Establishing no eye contact, on second thought, he concludes that an act of goodwill would only draw more attention to difference. For packages, right? So he plops down, relieved that only a few students are left standing. 5 local stops later, along with most other passengers, Duffy files out and through the turnstiles of the Cecil B. Moore station. As he passes through, he checks the clock behind the SEPTA ticket salesman. It is 10:10 a.m., which would not be so bad if his class were not a 5-minute walk from the station. He stumbles up the crowded steps and then picks up the pace, fast walking as best he can, feeling the familiar ache in the left hamstring, his would-be jumping leg, if Duffy could defy gravity just one little bit. On the first floor of Barron Hall, he rushes into the men's room to find both urinals busy, one with a student rep for the video game obesity generation, and the other with a sort of old fossil who'll just lean against the porcelain and let her drizzle for days, a scary reminder of what the latter years could be like. Duffy finds a stall vacant, save for a boat-sized bowel movement left floating for the next fellow to see. Disgusted, and suppressing the simultaneous urges to howl and heave, he pisses straight down, like a marksman gunning for old Brownsides rusting in the harbor. He forgets to flush, exits the stall, and breathes again. At the sink, he turns the hot water on full blast, feeling dirty and thus especially disappointed when all he gets is a lukewarm trickle. The soap dispenser fails to produce the pink ooze he can see in its packet, so he lets his hands soak under the faucet, admiring all the more his ideal form of government, the democracy in action of Urban State University. After shaking and rubbing his hands under the warm, faint breath of the sanitization system, Duffy returns to the stairs and ascends to meet his fate.